Welcome into the Podium Game Podcast. I'm Brian Gibberman, and Kevin Love's finally been traded. It's official, so we want to get a point of view from both sides. Jacob Rosen from Nylon Calculus and many other places is going to catch up with us in a little bit. But first, we're here with Steve McPherson. And with Steve, I think you just click on the internet and you can find him somewhere.
I'm always in there someplace.
Yeah, there's but the list that I found, Rolling Stone, Grantland, A Wolf Among Wolves, Hardwood Paraxum, 1500 ESPN, and The Classical. Did I miss anything?
Well, I mean, there's other things. Those are the places I feel like I've written for the most or am going to be writing for regularly. So there's little blips other places, but, you know, I think those are the high points. That's why that's on my Twitter bio. So.
Yes, obviously that's where I got my list from. how long have you been a Wolves fan for?
You know, I think that it really dates back to maybe the early 2000s. I was not huge into sports, actually, growing up. I played baseball I played through Little League, basically. And then I got into music and I stopped following sports a lot. But I started following basketball again after college, mostly via video games. I had a Dreamcast and I played NBA 2K, and I loved it, and so that sort of got me starting to follow basketball. And my parents, I actually grew up in Massachusetts, and my family had moved out to Minnesota when I was a junior in college, and so I grew up in Massachusetts, but not particularly near Boston, so I didn't really know anything about the Celtics. At the time, I was living in Connecticut, so I was kind of in Nowheresville related to any place, you know, in terms of being in a major metropolitan area. And I always liked Minnesota, and I really liked Kevin Garnett. So I think that's when I really started following them. And then it was really solidified in 2004, which was the year that I moved to the Twin Cities, and I got to experience their run to the Western Conference Finals. And that was the thing that really, I think, you know, solidified my fandom of the Wolves, and I've been a fan since then. Although I keep feeling that, like, over the last couple of years, now that I've been writing so much about basketball and am credentialed now with the Wolves, that it's less of a fan relationship. Like, I just spend too much time. You know, it's like a fan relationship is like, it's nice because you can walk away from it, but it's kind of a job at this point. So it doesn't feel as much like a fan relationship as it once did. There's no more cheering and jumping up and down in the seats, you know. So it's changed a little bit, but it's basically been since the early 2000s.
This was actually what your story, you wrote a story for Rolling Stone today, and it was called, hold on, let me scroll up, I was a little lower, Heartbreaker Remembering the Kevin Love Era in Minnesota. Make sure you go to rollingstone.com, check out that story. But, and that's kind of part of what I wanted to get into. Now, why don't you give how you will remember Kevin Love, and also if that's the same or do you think different from the majority of the fan base?
I think that it can be a little bit difficult right now in the moment to really understand how you're going to feel about a player. You know, months down the line, he comes back to the Target Center, I think at the end of January for the first time with the Cavs. It'll be interesting to see what the fans' reaction is at that time. I'm someone who's pretty easy going. I don't hold grudges, a lot of sports related grudges. I'm sort of interested in the now, and I just enjoy watching the game unfold on the court. So in the moment, I always appreciated Kevin Love on the team. I thought that he was underrated in a lot of ways. I think that Andrew Sharp from Grantland had a great tweet today where he said that Kevin Love is overrated as a number one player on a team and underrated as a number two player. And I think that it's very pithy, and I think it kind of sums up a lot of things about Kevin Love, that I think he's going to have a tremendous career. I think, you know, wherever it takes him, I think he's going to have a great run in Cleveland as a secondary or tertiary maybe option, depending on the situation. And I think that's perfect for him. I think there's nothing wrong with the fact that some players need other players around them. And I think increasingly the game is going in that direction where players need other players. There's fewer 20 point per game scorers now than there have been in the past. I think there's less ISO ball with the way that defenses have learned to play the game. So, you know, it's just one of those things where I don't think he has to, I think some people are probably going to remember him as the guy who couldn't get it done by himself in Minnesota, but Kevin Garnett was also kind of the guy who couldn't get it done by himself in Minnesota. You know, he had a lot more playoff runs, but a lot of those playoff runs were just one round before he got bounced. So, you know, it's one of those things where, like, I think I'm going to remember him fondly as a player. I think that there was a lot of things that happened in the last 3 years during this, you know, or the last couple years over the life of this most recent contract since the David Kahn debacle of the 4 year contract with the fourth year option. A lot of stuff that's happened in that time that wasn't Kevin Love's fault, that wasn't the Timberwolves' fault, that was just the way things happened, you know. And that's, I mean, there's plenty of stuff that are both of those parties' faults. I just think that it's such a rich, crazy, complicated mess of things that happen. It's hard to assign blame really easily, especially this close to how everything went down. I think as we see what Kevin Love looks like outside of Minnesota, it's probably going to change our, you know, maybe it's going to make us understand him a little better. I'm going to remember him fondly. I don't know how fondly anybody else is going to remember him. I think I've seen a lot of people who want to thank him for his time in Minnesota, and I've seen a lot of people who still want to kind of, you know, slag him for not getting to the playoffs. So it's going to run both ways. I expect he'll probably get booed when he comes back to Target Center because that's what happens in sports, right? So, but I will remember him fondly.
It really is amazing that just someone who's had so much individual success and put up the numbers that he has, it's really, really unusual for them not to have more team success. And I'm not blaming, same with you, I'm not blaming him. I'm not blaming, I guess I would blame the team a little bit that they didn't surround him better. Where do you think they missed most in the players they had around him?
Well, I think that, you know, one thing that was interesting is I went back when I was working on that article and I watched the 31.31 rebound game that was kind of his coming out game.
It doesn't count. Amari Stoudemire was playing center.
Well, they were playing a Knicks team that was like, looking back at it, I was like, oh, against the Knicks and Carmelo. Oh, no, Carmelo wasn't on that team. It was like, you know.
It was
like
earlier Gallo, that year, yeah.
Felton. So, you know, so obviously there's that proviso with it. But watching that game, it was interesting because he only shot 4 3-pointers, and he was 1 for 4. He did all of his damage down in the post almost, you know, and it was like he sort of used his rebounding to fuel this little explosion of points down the stretch of the game. But one thing that the commentators, like, I think Frazier was talking about this, that, the, you know, they moved Al Jefferson to make room for Kevin Love, which I remember at the time you were like, oh, yeah, well, you've got these two low post players. But now you're like, wait, you moved a center to make room for a stretch four, which is like, the more I think about it, the more it's like, I know there's a lot of mistakes that were made, you know, by Randy Whitman with him in terms of, you know, discouraging him from shooting the three-pointer. There's mistakes that Rambis made. I think Rambis was a terrible, awful coach. There's a lot of mistakes that get made there, and there's a lot of mistakes that get made later in terms of how they build the team around him. But things like that, it's like, you know, and then you see that they've ended up with Pekovic, who's essentially like another ground-bound, offensive-oriented center who took a couple more years to come around. It's like, you could have had Al Jefferson, you know, who in a good team defensive system in Charlotte was actually a pretty good defender by the numbers. I mean, you know, he's not going to block shots, but, you know, little things like that. I think that not understanding Kevin Love for the first 2 to 3 years of his career in Minnesota was one of the things that just made it really hard to throw the brakes on and change how they built the team around him. You know, you wanted this stuff to come around. You wanted to think that, hey, you get Rubio, who's a dynamic pass first point guard, and you've got, you know, a scoring power forward. These guys should just mesh and work terrifically together. And in some situations they did, but then they also brought in Adelman, who, you know, is a great coach with a fantastic system in terms of the corner offense, which he didn't even get to run that much the first, you know, the first year or two he was there because of the personnel problems they had with injuries. But when it sort of started, you know, they struggled last year. When that system started running, a lot of times you would see Rubio sort of dump it to Love at the elbow and then, you know, become an off-the-ball player, which is not really what Rubio is great at. So, and that's not the, you know, the bench was a root of their problem. You know, the starters were very good last season. I don't mean to say that the system didn't work. When the system worked, it worked great. You know, they also had the most blowout wins of any team last season, you know, wins by 20 points or more. They had the most in the NBA. So, you know, when it was clicking, it was great. It was just that if it ever got close, they were just get sucked into the wood chipper and ground out the back, you know. So little things like that. There's like a lot of little mistakes along the way. I don't think it was – I think that – and I think it goes back even farther than thinking about this most recent iteration of the team. I think he was misunderstood as a player, both in terms of thinking of him as being the franchise cornerstone and in terms of what his game was going to be, basically from the beginning.
So from what I can garner from you with Love, you think he's best off playing with another ball-dominant player that lets him play off of. So you think LeBron or someone of that ilk is the best situation for him?
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things that, you know, he gets a lot of grief for not closing out games or not being able to close games. But it's like, you know, you're a 6'10", generously. I mean, he's I believe he's literally 6'7" and three quarters or something. You know, you're a power forward who can't put the ball on the floor and create for yourself. And this leaves him to, you know, be fed the ball by a lot of players who either couldn't handle the ball. Like Kevin Martin can't really handle the ball. He can shoot the ball, but he can't handle it. Rubio can handle the ball, but he can't really shoot it. So, you know, everybody is such a unidirectional threat that was on this roster that when it came down to the end of games, you know, to be like, okay, let's give it to Love and see what he can do, you know, he can't do a lot other than, like, catch it and shoot it at the three-point arc, or maybe, you know, getting clutch baskets down low is a very difficult thing to do. And he did it a couple times. I think that in terms of the fact of how good his rebounding is, the fact that he can make those three-pointers, he could, you know, his mid-range game is pretty decent, and his post-game has come a long way. He's also good in terms of assisting. You know, he brought his assists way up last season. I think that he's multidimensional. He's not unidirectional in the way some of these other guys are. It's just that there's certain dimensions he doesn't have, and those dimensions are some of the important ones to be a dominant player. So I think pairing him as you know, a running partner with somebody like James, or, you know, I think the Irving Love combination could have been really interesting, regardless of James being in Cleveland or not. You know, Irving as a point guard who's more of a scoring point guard than Rubio certainly is. You know, I think that, again, I think that Kevin Love took a lot of shots and because he had to, because there weren't a lot of other people who were doing that for the Wolves. And I think that he was very efficient even within that setting. And I think he's going to be more of scarily efficient, actually, especially paired with somebody like LeBron, who is already also scarily efficient. So I think it's going to be fun. Cleveland's going to be a ton of fun to watch. I mean, I'm excited. I think I'm going to get to enjoy Love a little more because I don't have to worry so much about him on the Wolves, actually.
You brought up Garnett a couple times earlier. Was there was the reaction to Love being traded similar or different to when Garnett was traded?
I think it's a little different because the Garnett thing was coming on for longer. You know, I think that there's still – I do think – the contracts – Love's contract made this difficult to see out. But I could have seen this season starting with Love on the roster and them returning fundamentally the same starting lineup, doing some work with the bench and having a ton more success than they had last year. Like, that fully could have happened. I think that you could have seen, like, I was earlier, before a lot of the trade stuff came up, I was sort of thinking that you might see like a sort of Blazers type turnaround where the Blazers were not very good. They got a decent bench and suddenly they looked like so much better. But a lot of that was just, you know, like they just needed a couple little tweaks. And I think the Wolves could have done that. I mean, I think that they suffered from some bad luck in those close losses. I think that some of those bad close losses early sort of cast a pall over the team, especially given the threat of Love leaving. So without that threat of Love leaving, maybe they would have soldiered on a little better through those things. You know, they were just pressing a lot last year. So it's the kind of thing where maybe they could have had last year happen, and then if they weren't under this pressure, they could have had a much better season this year and then gone on to have some success, you know, maybe made the playoffs. You know, so that sense of it sort of being abandoned in media res is a little different. Like with Garnett, you know, they had the great, you know, 2004 playoffs, and then all the trouble with, you know, Sprewell's contract and Cassell's contract over the next season, and the team just kind of fell apart for the next couple years until Garnett, you know, eventually got out. And as Flip Saunders pointed this out in the press conference, that, you know, Kevin Garnett wasn't – he wanted to stay in Minnesota. Like, he had a no-trade clause, which he exercised more or less, you know, a couple times as they brought up the question of how they're going to rebuild it. But it was only once it really became clear, like, this is a thorough, to-the-studs kind of rebuild, that he decided he wanted to get out of there. And they, you know, they tried – get as good a situation for him as possible, which obviously they did. You know, the Celtics were a great team for him to go to. So I think that the feeling is a little different. I'm sure that right now the wound for some people in Minnesota is going to be is worse right now. I think a lot of people were hurt when Garnett left as well, but I think that people felt like he was a better soldier than Kevin Love has been. So I think overall the feeling was maybe not as negative when Garnett left.
Would have your excitement level been higher for the team they've constructed now, or, as you just mentioned, watching them try and be last year's Blazers with Love back? Which one do you think would have generated more excitement in Minnesota?
You know, obviously them returning that team and that team getting to the playoffs would have been more exciting. I don't think there's any way that this team, you can reasonably expect that they will go to the playoffs at this point. Personally, from a strictly personal standpoint, and I think that it hopefully that comes across in the Rolling Stone article, like, I was just kind of tired of the Love era of trying to struggle our way into the playoffs. That was just, you know, he was, and then from a greedily personal standpoint, you know, in terms of him as a personality on the team to cover, he was so shut off a lot of the time, you know, with some reason from media. But it was just, you know, I had a couple times where I got to talk to him one-on-one about different things, and he was, you know, he was cordial. He was more talkative than he would be in the media scrums. But it was just, he was so glum kind of all the time. And it just felt like it just wasn't fun for him. I think it wasn't fun for Rubio. I think Rubio was being a good teammate, a good junior teammate, in that he was following Love's, you know, the way that Love conducted himself to a certain extent. I think we can see a very different Rubio this season, in terms of in the locker room and his personality on the court, which I think could be exciting. So personally, I'm sort of excited to have young, you know, fresh legs in there. Again, I'm somebody who came into the first team I really liked in the NBA was the Hawks back in the 90s. I used to watch them on TNT when TNT only showed Hawks games because they were on the Atlanta station. And that was Dominique Wilkins, and that's what I loved. So I loved Vince Carter. You know, his slam dunk his slam dunk win was like one of the formative experiences of me saying, like, I really enjoy this game. So for me, I'm excited to see a bunch of high flyers. This is a kind of team that Minnesota's never had before. They built around Garnett, who was a power forward. They kind of started building around Jefferson, who's a power forward or center. And then they built around Love, who's a power forward. And you know, especially Jefferson and Love, neither of them had really, you know, that sexy high-flying game. So they've never really had athletic wings. I mean, Fred Hoiberg, great, great shooter, and clearly a very good coach now, but he's not going to dunk anything. So, you know, I like dunks. I mean, come on. Like, I like entertainment. So I'm excited for this. I'm excited for the season. And also Thad Young is absolutely my favorite player in the league, you know. So I'm excited to have Thad Young on my team now.
Two things off of what you just said. I'm going to start with the team that they have now. I don't think they're playoff teams by any mean, but Pekovic, Thad Young, and then if Rubio kind of progresses in his career as you would expect, it's not the worst top three players on your team.
Really? No, certainly not.
Go ahead.
That as a top three, again, it's one of those things where, you know, you look at those stats about Love never having played with another all-star or never having played with anybody who accumulated more than 7 win shares. You know, there is something to that, and I don't know if Rubio is ever going to be an all-star caliber point guard, but, you know, I think that Saunders referenced them maybe having some of the possibility of some of that kind of surprising Phoenix Suns thing go on with them this season, which is an outlier. I think it's a small percentage chance that something like that gels that quickly, but, you know, you never know. Like Wiggins could suddenly look a lot farther along than we thought he did offensively. There could be certain moves that, you know, I think Brewer coming off the bench would be a good move. I think Brewer as a starter was kind of unconvincing, but as an energy guy on defense and in transition against second units, like, you know, little things. things could happen, and I don't think they're going to be an awful team to. I think they're going to be a really fun team to watch. They're not going to win. I think it was Alex Dewey who had my favorite thing so far that anybody said about this Wolves team, which is that they might only win 30 games, but each of those games is going to start its own band, which is a great reference to the Velvet Underground thing about not selling very many records, but all of the people who bought that record starting a band in terms of influence. So I think it's going to be a beloved team in a lot of ways, if not a hugely successful team.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to watching them a ton. The other thing, you talked about Rubio changing his personality with Love. How would you describe Rubio and Love's relationship?
Well, I think that, I think that in sports, it's very distinct in sports, but I think it happens in a lot of situations where people who are veterans, the way you're a good teammate is by following, your veteran leader's lead. And Kevin Love is the all-star on the team and sort of the face of the franchise was the leader. And I think he was very determined. Rubio talked a lot about they got to win some games. And I believe, Rubio obviously wanted to win games. But you would see these little flashes of Rubio where, when he first came out in his rookie season and he kind of stepped in, and he had this flair and this sort of effervescence, and all the teammates were really loving it, and the crowd was loving it, and it was great and entertaining. It had this real good vibe feeling to it that just, obviously when he went down with his ACL injury, I think that affected him personally a little bit, and that was a little hard for him to come back from. But I think he sort of tamped down some of that natural effervescence, some in an effort to become a better player, which is admirable, some because I think that Adelman and he didn't have a fantastic relationship. I lean a little bit towards that I think the difficult relationship last year was not between Rubio and Love, but between Rubio and Adelman, because it seemed clear that Adelman didn't feel like Rubio could be trusted with the ball as the point guard late in games. He was giving it over to Barea a lot down the stretch, which didn't work either. And I just sort of thought that you just kind of got to let Rubio be Rubio at some point. And I hope that's what happens. Like, they let that. And again, it's one of those things where I'm not saying that him being Rubio is going to lead to a lot more wins. I just think that you got to let that come out. And I think you're gonna prosper and benefit by the way it feeds the team in a positive way. So I think Rubio and Love probably have a fine relationship. They always seemed like they were good playing together. I didn't think there was ever any animosity between the two of them. But I just think we're going to see Rubio maybe get to be, between he and Pekovic, they're sort of like the vets on the team. Thad Young now has as many NBA years as Peck and Rubio put together. But Young is like, he's the ultimate like good citizen, good soldier, do what has to be done for the good of the team, hardworking guy. I don't think he's like a vocal leader. I think Rubio might get to have that chance to step out and set the tone of the team, which I think could be a lot of fun because he's a lot of fun.
Did this trade change how people viewed Flip Saunders at all?
I think a lot of people are pretty excited about how well he did. And I think that some people are probably going to shy away from giving him too much credit for it and say that this is really on LeBron, like LeBron should win GM of the year for organizing this. But I think Saunders had to hold a pretty firm line, through the draft and through the end of last season and in spots like to say, no, like what we want is a home run. And he talked about this in terms of drafting LaVine. He keeps saying that obviously LaVine maybe had the most upside at that point of anyone they could have drafted. He probably wasn't the most ready player, but they wanted to go for a home run, not a double, is the thing he keeps saying. It's the thing he said to me twice specifically. So, I think that sense is maybe underrated, that I think he did hold the line pretty well as a GM. It'll be interesting to see. I'm still a little skeptical of the whole GM-coach relationship working out in this situation. I don't think it's kind of the vogue thing to have in the NBA right now. I think it works very specifically for the Spurs. Obviously they have Buford, but I think but Buford and Popovich really work together a lot in terms of roster construction. So, and Popovich was the GM before Buford, I believe, as well. So I don't necessarily think that it's the best combination to have, but I also think that people thought that people didn't want them to get Young. especially for Bennett, because they felt like, hey, you know, we're getting another young player, like you're just getting Thad Young to try to win now. But I think that, and I think Flip has emphasized this also in some interviews, that, you know, they wanted to get a veteran presence who could be a mentor for these young players. Like they didn't have a power forward on the roster who had started any NBA games at that point. So, you know, to me, that's smart. It's like you need a certain amount of veterans to carry the team. You can't just have, you know, 2 to 3 rookies out there on the floor and expect something to happen, like in terms, not just in terms of wins, but in terms of growth. So I think the move is probably a balanced one between growth and also trying to put a competitive team on the floor, because being competitive is part of how players learn to grow, how they grow and learn the game. So I think that maybe it's changed some people. I think that I didn't really know what to expect with Saunders, and I think that I'm impressed that he pulled this off. It's not, you know, there wasn't any last minute thing where he suddenly got more or got less than we thought he was going to get. This is, like you said, this is essentially the deal that's been in place for quite a while now. So, but I think that people should be, you know, fairly impressed with the way Flip has run this offseason as a whole.
And the other thing with Thad Young, he's 26 years old. There's absolutely no reason the T-Wolves can't re-sign him at a reasonable value and have him be a part of this core going forward. I think that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. I mean, there's obviously with any player, there could be some situation where suddenly it's like, you know, he wants $12 million or something like that, you know, or some amount, or he wants a max, or some team's going to give him the max or something like that. And that can start messing up things. But I think that Young's value in terms of, you know, he would make $10 million next year if he doesn't opt out, 10.1, I think. I think his value is kind of reasonably set. And if he's really good and he deserves more money, that would be great. There's a lot of situations like that on this team, which I'm okay with. You know, like there's stuff about Rubio trying to push for the max, like his agent is pushing for the max, which is his agent. That's his agent's job. You know, he should be pushing for the max. I don't think Rubio deserves the max right now, but there are worse things than Rubio playing this season like a max player and then getting the max. You know, if he actually shows it, I have no problem with that. If at the end of the season he hasn't quite shown it, but he, you know, he's still maybe slightly overpaid, and he's at like $12 million, something like that, and then he actually becomes better still the next year, you know, then he becomes kind of a value. So, you know, I think that Young, there's reasons he might try to go elsewhere, but I think that if the team is successful, I think you might see that at 26 he can be like, you know, a good veteran leader on a team that's young and getting better. And I think that's got to carry some weight with players, especially guys like Young, who I think are really interested in winning and not necessarily in being superstars. I mean, I can't speak. I spoke to Thad Young once after a game. So, but it seems like his attitude is not like, I'm going to be the man on the team that I'm on. It seems like he's going to play to the system and play to win and work hard. And those are great qualities.
Already mentioned the Rolling Stone story. Go to rollingstone.com, Heartbreaker, Remembering the Kevin Love Era in Minnesota. Anything else you'd like to plug, get out there?
Oh, I don't know. What else is out there? I just started writing for 1500 ESPN, which is kind of fun, the ESPN radio affiliate here in the Twin Cities. So I just wrote a thing up for them, which was about possible rotations. You know, what we might see on the floor from the Wolves, just on my own speculation. So that's at 1500ESPN.com. That's the recent stuff. I'm working on some other things. The Wolves are announcing they're going to be at they're unveiling their players at the State Fair, the Minnesota State Fair tomorrow, which is like the most Minnesotan thing ever. Like to bring out your highly athletic young core at the place that's famous for like cheese curds and corn dogs. So so I'm going to be writing that up. So that'll be up in the next couple of days.
Keep an eye out for that. Are we going to get the Steve McPherson radio show in the near future?
I think I'm going to get to do some radio on 1500 ESPN from time to time, but I will not have my own shock jock talk show yet. So I need to get more sound effects on my computer before I do
that. Yet there's, you know, the board where you push the buttons and it makes all the noises play. Those are always fun to play with during radio shows.
Yeah.
I've worked in radio for about 10 years. It's writing's easier. Well, no, I don't know. They're both hard.
I can't tell. You know, like, I can't tell. I did some radio stuff when I was a DJ when I was in college, and I've hosted some. I've done sub guest hosting shows for different things, and I love doing it. I love doing podcasts like this, or you know, talking is also good. Writing is also good. They're both good. You're right. They're both good. And they're both hard in their own ways.
The PD at the radio station I work at part time in Arizona won't let me go anywhere near a microphone for a full show. I've produced and been allowed to chime in occasionally, but they don't let me talk on the regular.
Yeah, I think radio is one of those things that you listen to it and you're like, I could do that. You know, like, it's just, you're just talking. And then you see what actually goes into making a show like that. And people are running around like crazy all the time, you know, behind the scenes, during breaks, you know, just to make everything seem like it's super easy to do. There's a lot that goes into it. I'm definitely aware of that.
And talking for 4 hours, whether you think the person's stupid or smart, is really hard to do.
It is.
All right, Steve, thank you very much. From the team that's still in the rebuilding process now to the team that rebuilt itself in one summer, I'm joined by Jacob Rosen from one of our sister websites, or whatever you call that when it's linked under the same network, HP Network, Nylon Calculus. He also writes for Waiting for Next Year and the Sports Analytics blog. Jacob, how you doing today?
Good, how are you? Thanks for having me along.
Thank you. No, thank you for taking time out. So when the Cavs season ended, what was your expectations for the offseason?
Mild improvements, maybe a Trevor Ariza signing here or a Chandler Parsons signing there. And, you know, keeping with the young guns that we had and just trying to, you know, inch above 500 if we could next season and contend for the playoffs. That's where we were 4 months ago.
And it's a lot different now. Side note, if you don't know, Jacob is, in addition to doing all the right basketball writing, he is a Cavs fan, so that's why we wanted to get his perspective on their off season. At what point did you think the LeBron James thing was real and could actually happen?
I remember it was July 4 weekend, and I was in Chicago with my brother, and around that time, I just kept hearing things from people. And, you know, there had been this rumors about this for, you know, years on end now. And it got hot, you know, by the middle of June. And it just was going crazy from July 1 on. I remember July 4 weekend. That weekend is when I finally got, you know, convinced this could, oh my gosh, this should actually probably might happen. And the announcement then came the next Friday. And I still wasn't really believing. I remember it was Friday morning. I was off work that day. And I hopped in the shower maybe about 11:30. Just thinking, all right, so Jacob, you know, what if this actually does happen? What if, you know, those people you're hearing from were actually going to be correct? Like, what would you even do with yourself if that was even right? I hop out of the shower, look at my phone, and it's just absolutely blowing up. And that was that. That was how I found out about the decision. And I just pretty much stood there for a half hour texting everyone I knew.
So in the year since he's left, like, just people talking in Cleveland and around Cleveland, you're from Akron and in that area, were there always people kind of saying, hey, I know LeBron's going to come back? Like, that was a thing that really happened?
I didn't hear it all the time. I heard from some folks, just, you know, being in Akron, he's always been so good to the city of Akron and the kids at his high school and the kids in the community. A lot of fans, you know, kind of tuned it off. You know, certainly the first year, there was a big Cavs or Mavs kind of thing in the finals, but, you know, by year three or four in Miami, you know, fans were just, all right, there's that player who happens to be from Akron, he's quite good still, but I don't think there's really any realistic optimism about it. There's a couple of crazies, but really until sometime in June-ish, there was no thought there was at all a possibility.
All right, so the first step in this offseason was getting LeBron, then the next thing, you know, holy shit, Kevin Love's also coming here. Do you think the Warriors overplayed their leverage or made a really bad decision, whichever way you want to go? Did the Cavs do the opposite? Do you think they didn't use their leverage enough in their dealings with Minnesota, or are you just okay with how it all played out?
I think, you know, when you talk about the first step of the Cavs offseason, it was, oh my God, we just won the lottery again. Third time in 4 years. It was insane. And that enabled Kevin Love to happen. If the Cavs don't get Andrew Wiggins, we're talking about a trade of, you know, a Doug McDermott or you know, Nick Stauskas, and that's just not an enticing offer, really. So I think after the Cavs won the lottery and then got LeBron, that magical thing made the Kevin Love trade, in my mind, perfectly fine. I wasn't going to complain really about the trade much. I wasn't one of the fans that was really opposed to it from the get-go. I always saw the value in Kevin Love as another top 10 player, and Wiggins is a guy who could still be very good, but he's still only 19 and, you know, won't be a top 10 player for at least several seasons. So in that regard, I always was on board with this trade idea.
You're a big stats guy, so Wiggins in a lot of the stat projections doesn't do very well. His numbers don't project very well.
Very well, yeah. I remember looking at it. But right before the draft, I had this huge mega post on all the analytics behind you know, projections that are out there publicly. And it just doesn't look that great. He wasn't that good at Kansas. And the things he does particularly well, which are athleticism and defense, aren't very easy to quantify in terms of what we know about how to qualify the game of basketball. His impact was actually less on the defensive end in terms of like plus minus statistics and such than Jabari Parker's, who is often criticized for his defense. So what we saw from Andrew Wiggins last year didn't immediately scream he's going to be a stud from day one. Anthony Davis was like that. Nerlens Noel was like that. Kyrie Irving was kind of like that, although he only played like 10 games at Duke. But Wiggins just was not. I think, you know, the hype about this draft was insane. He's still going to probably be quite good, but it wasn't a guarantee that he'd be even an average player this season.
That's, I mean, it leads into another whole conversation of how to quantify numbers in college when you play different levels of competition. Like the on-off court, I think all of it's really, really hard to deal with, and that's why I think that stuff with college isn't really... You don't see it as much. Like, we can get all this NBA. Number one, there's 550 teams, but it's also not as publicly available as it is compared to the NBA.
And one could easily make the argument that Wiggins' game will transition more efficiently into the NBA game, where it's more open of court. There's a 3-second rule, things like that. So, just from what we know, it's not a lot. It's really also a very small sample size too, because the number of the games, it's like half of an NBA season, and he's an 18-year-old kid. So there's a lot of guesswork that goes into it. I would just say that, you know, just from those numbers and such, I wasn't that overblown by the need to keep an Andrew Wiggins type when a Kevin Love was on the table.
The biggest concern, and that I think is very fair, whether it's you garner it by looking at numbers or watching him play, is that his passing ability is something that you want a better passer from a wing position. I think that's a very fair criticism.
I remember Shabazz Muhammad last year. He had, you know, how many games with zero assists at UCLA. Wiggins was almost like that. But at least Wiggins, you know, he's a very good rebounder. He's an excellent offensive rebounder for his position. He projects as being much better at steals than a guy like Shabazz Muhammad. So, you know, the assists worried me, but I think he did so many other things on the court that it wasn't just necessarily that.
How do you feel they filled out the roster around Kyrie, Love, and LeBron?
Okay. Anyone can point out the obvious flaw in a lack of an actual rim protector. They kind of had to, in a sense, give away Tyler Zeller to unload Jared Jack. But now they just are left with Anderson Varejao, Tristan Thompson, and Kevin Love as actual big men besides LeBron James and Sean Marion. The roster is okay. I think it should still be sufficient enough to get a number one seed. And in the playoffs, you do have LeBron. But yeah, it's not complete. It's not a gimme. It's not anything perfect. They really could use another backup point guard with experience. Matthew Dellavedova was a lot of fun last year and quite good analytically. But he's still a very young point guard. And if, you know, the going gets tough in the playoffs, they have pretty much right now LeBron, Kyrie, and Deion Waiters. And it would make sense to perhaps have another backup point guard, especially in case of any injuries. And then, obviously, the center. I think they have right now, especially if they were to get Ray Allen, enough shooters. They have, you know, a good amount of wings that can play defense, especially with Marion doing that role in a hybrid sort of sense. And they have a ton of rebounders. They have a ton of scorers. They're going to be insanely fun to watch offensively. It's just the defense, and it's the, you know, because of that, the rim protection. So that's the issue.
It seems like one of those scored, the fourth guy that doesn't get included in the whatever big three, whatever the hell people want to call him, is Deion Waiters. And it seems like recently, and you guys did a whole video on him talking, comparing him and Bradley Beal. The perception of his game has seemed to have sort of a shift as people have looked at his numbers more, watched him more. How do you think his game fits in with these three players?
You know, he's the backup. He's a backup, you know, guy to bring up the ball to the court. And in an ideal sense, he's catching and shooting. He's cutting off screens. It fits well within what we've seen videos of David Blatt and how he ran his offense over in Israel and Europe. Waiters is going to just be the backup guy. You know, in the past, if you look at his numbers, you have to always have the caveat to the fact that he had 27% usage. That's insane usage. Look at a guy like Chandler Parsons. And the efficiency he was able to produce in Houston with that system and about a 19% usage, maybe a 20% usage for his career. Waiters at 27. So everything efficiency-wise for Deion Waiters the last couple of years with his very inconsistent shooting and the turnovers and all that is given with the caveat of all that usage. Now it will be well under 20% playing with Love, Irving, and LeBron. And the fact that he will just now be catching and shooting, which he did actually quite well last season. He had very good catch-and-shoot numbers, better than Bradley Beal, better than Irving, and he was improving in the second halves of each of the past two seasons. So the hope would be that there is actually, you know, improvement happening and that he's now in such a low-pressured environment where he's just shooting threes and he's just cutting and he's not forced to bring the ball up and shoot at every opportunity he can, and that the coaches would then rear him back to make sure he doesn't do that. And in the past years, it was almost necessary for the Cavs to have anybody that could create offense or score. Now it's certainly not an issue.
Are you worried about the mental aspect of him accepting that role, or do you think he'll be fine with it?
I'm not too worried. I said in the analytics salon the other day that every team is a little crazy. It is a monstrous coaching task ahead of David Blatt to capture all those personalities, and Deion Waiters being one of them, and getting them to accept their necessary roles. But I think Deion is such a fierce competitor that it shouldn't be too much of an issue. There are many other issues at hand for David Blatt to figure out how he could get a top 10 defense out of this team and to figure out how it can all gel together and to manage all those personalities, and Deion's just one of them.
Do you think there's any way or pieces that they have that could end up turning into another big man that's more of a rim protector?
They have assets, you know, still, somewhat. They have the Utah guys that are unguaranteed that they could figure out a way to deal with them either in another, you know, couple weeks or maybe at some time during the season. At some point, they could use Brandon Haywood's contract. I'm not sure if he's even physically able to compete in the NBA right now. He didn't play much last season, if at all, I forget. But he's got a $10 million expiring contract next summer that is completely unguaranteed. So that could be a trade piece this offseason at his current base salary, or it could be something for next offseason. The big question is Tristan Thompson. He's got a qualifying offer for next season on the table, and they have a few more weeks to decide on a potential extension. So if Tristan is the guy they're way behind, that could work. If not, they have minor assets at least to figure out some way to make a move.
How concerned are you about with the Tristan Thompson situation, that with Rich Paul's agent, who's LeBron's agent, that they might end up overpaying him to, as it was kind of a side deal to LeBron coming back?
I'm not too concerned about it. Certainly one could make the argument that Rich Paul would want his client to get the most money possible, and that would obviously be in Cleveland, but I'm not too worried about that situation happening. There are many worse things than giving Tristan Thompson some money long-term, and if the Cavs really are, you know, it's almost as logical as saying that Dan Gilbert will pay the tax with no regard for humanity. And he could. It's possible. I don't know. We haven't seen Dan Gilbert in this tax environment. So it could happen, and it could not be a big deal at all. I'm not sure. I'm not too worried about it.
All right, I'm going to throw my batshit crazy idea at you and see what you think. I kind of thought LeBron, Love, and Wiggins made more sense as your top three from how they fit together more than LeBron, Love, and Kyrie.
They wouldn't be good enough this year. This would be my immediate retort. And they weren't trading Irving. It just wasn't a thing that would be a logical thing for a franchise to do at this point in time. Irving got the max in part not just because of, you know, his mostly okay, goodish last years, but because of who he is, the pedigree, the point guardness, the MVP, the All-Star game. It wasn't even a fact that he would be traded. And I think in the next 2 or 3 years, you would probably still take Irving over Wiggins in that big three, just because of what he's, you know, the age, the transition to the NBA and everything. Long term, in 4 or 5 years, maybe, but by that point, LeBron is 32 or 33. And you just don't know.
So, yeah, their timelines just don't match up. My thought process was basically having another wing that can help LeBron and him, have him not have to defend the other opponent's best ball creator. And you don't need as much of Kyrie's shot creation because you have LeBron there, so you're okay with someone who plays off the ball, does cuts and all that stuff.
It's obviously an impossible scenario. But I think given Sean Marion, it makes Wiggins, at least his departure for this year, next perhaps a little more okay, because Marion's a guy who has averaged 30 minutes a game for 4 years for Dallas, a very solid team. And Irving's ball creation is exactly the kind of thing we were talking about in Miami, where they didn't have another guy that could really do it all the time. They had Wade, and we have Waiters a little bit, who's certainly not as good, and hasn't been as good. But Irving is a guy that can create, and that's perhaps a good thing with LeBron. So, you know, it is what it is in a sense. I didn't buy too much into ever considering trading Kyrie at any point.
Yeah, and as you said, there's business aspects of this that have to be considered, which makes my, as I said, batshit crazy idea. That's why I put it as that.
Yeah.
That it just doesn't make sense on many levels.
Yeah. That's fun.
It is. It's just fun to look at different things and come up with different ideas. Because just that, at least Minnesota didn't take Clay and Lee.
Mm-hmm.
That I would have felt bad for them if they did that.
Minnesota got lucky. The Cavs got lucky. It's been a really weird summer. I remember, like, for years, Cavs fans were trying to come up with scenarios to actually get Kevin Love. And, oh my gosh, it just happened. So it's amazing how different things are than 4 months ago or 7 months ago when we were trading for Spencer Hawes and Luol Deng and trying to make a playoff run. And now we're suddenly the favorite to win the NBA title. It's really weird times in Cleveland.
Do you have anything you want to plug or anything like that?
I wrote a really long article over at Waiting for Next Year, where I've been writing for 5 or 6 years now, about Kevin Love and all the stats and all the common criticisms of him. So if folks want to check that out, as you know, all the numbers on Kevin Love, I had a lot of fun just looking through all the articles written about his criticisms, the fourth quarters for Minnesota, and you know, how good could he be if they keep missing the playoffs kind of stuff. So I spent a lot of time on it. It's a massive analytics thing. So if folks want to check that one out, they can.
All right. So go to waitingfornextyear.com to go see that story. Jacob, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thanks to Steve McPherson also, who joined us earlier from the Timberwolves perspective. And that wraps up this edition of the Podium Game Podcast.